Ted Peters, welcome to the future of our planet, a very modest topic, narrow in scope and easy to handle. I teach theology at Pacific Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, California, for young men and women who are entering the ministry. Not all of them are so young anymore. I have some students that are older than I am, many second career people going into the pastoral ministry. We also have a PhD program in concert with the University of California at Berkeley, and a THD program which we do with the Graduate Theological Union. My field is systematic theology. It's sometimes called Christian doctrine. That means we talk about the Apostles' Creed, but we try to do it in light of the 20th century. And it's my belief that theology should be responsive. Otherwise, we could simply repeat what the Bible says again and again. But what keeps theology alive is that in each new situation in which we find ourselves, we try to respond and to reconceive the things that we believe in light of that. And what I would like to do this afternoon is describe the present situation in which we find ourselves, and then tomorrow suggest my way of reconceiving of the whole idea of God and of Christ in light of what I consider future consciousness so important to us at present. The overriding theme, for those of you that attended my Bible study on Revelation will remember, comes in a little limerick. It goes like this: God created the world in the beginning. We humans spoiled it by sinning. We know that the story will end in God's glory, but right now the other side is winning. And what we're going to talk about today is the other side. Clearly, tomorrow we'll get back to God and his victory, but today, how the other side is winning. One time, a congregation invited a futurist to come for their Sunday night bean supper, and after the clacking of the dishes had been completed, the futurist gave his after-dinner talk. And he said, "My topic is the future, but I want to tell you all that there isn't going to be any. That what we can look forward to with the rising energy prices, inflation, the depletion of non-renewable natural resources, the overgrowth of population, the undersupply of food, is going to be mass starvation and political turmoil throughout the world. The poor are going to rise up against the rich. There will be rioting in the streets, which will lead to international war. This will finally precipitate a thermonuclear exchange. The entire planet will be blown apart, and life will be a thing of the past." And he sat down. There was a moment of silence, and finally a little old lady stood up in the back of the church. And this little old lady has been in every congregation that I've been in, and probably in yours too. And she says, "I think something very serious has been said here this evening. And I think it requires a full commitment on the part of all of us. Would it help if I baked a cake?" One of the things I think about when we think about the future, when we think about the prognostications and the forecasts of our futurists, especially when the forecasts are of the doom variety, is that we think that the forces that are propelling the present generation into the future towards the disasters that are being projected are overwhelming, and that somehow or other baking a cake is so trivial that it cannot really contribute to the solution of this massive problem. On the other hand, I don't think that we should let CBS News or any other future forecasters define reality for us. Reality isn't just the way it appears for those people who believe in God. I think that if we trust that God does have an ultimate plan for the course of nature and history, then baking a cake is good stewardship, and that we have to trust, we have to have the confidence that that in some way or another does finally participate in the divine providence. And that even though it may appear to be trivial, that the reality upon which we place our faith and our confidence is God, and that that sort of thing is meaningful, and that baking a cake is one way of this little old lady's taking seriously Jesus' parable of the talents. Whether you have 3, 2, or 1 talents, whatever it is, we don't bury it, but we exploit it for what we believe to be God's ministry, and we're going to have to do that with some hope. But Christian hope is realistic. It is not naive. And it's the non-naive side of Christian hope that I really want to deal with today. With regard to materials and things related to what I want to talk about, let me mention that basically what we'll be dealing with today is material that I've tried to put in print to a greater or lesser degree in my book, Fear, Faith, and the Future, which is a book that we do have here at the Holden Village Bookstore. Another book that I've asked the bookstore to get, if you'd really like a nice compendium of relevant factual data with regard to trends in non-renewable natural resource depletion, population growth, economic trends, etc., is a book published by the World Council of Churches called Faith, Science, and the Future, a paperback, which is also in our bookstore. And not related to this topic, but I just want to mention it. Next week I'm going to have one lecture on life beyond death, and I've put a very excellent book in there, Hans Schwartz's Beyond the Gates of Death, if that is a topic that interests you, and just in case you won't be here next week for that discussion. I might also mention that I'm a member of the World Future Society. That's not a Christian organization by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, whenever Christianity is discussed, they usually spit west or make snide remarks or something like that. Nevertheless, the humanistic values of that organization do make it a useful resource for Christians. And I will mention the Futurist magazine as we talk. Is there any other member of the World Future Society here? Let me just mention, it has an excellent, excellent publication. It's very bourgeois, but even with that, it still has a sense of the world problematique and the concern that rich people should be having for poor, but it's a constant update in the latest trends in technology and social science. This issue is dedicated to the future of medical services. But there are always other articles. There's one in here on cultivision, that is to say, with the new changes in mass media, what is it going to do to religious broadcasting? It's a lousy article, but occasionally there are really good articles. I find it one of the best sources of continuing information because the most prominent futurists, Herman Kahn at the Hudson Institute, Lester Brown at World Watch Institute, and others are frequent contributors. If anyone is interested, I've got some order blanks here, and you're welcome to pick one up. Also on the order blanks are advertisements for a couple of more books, one of which I've written, Futures, Human, and Divine, and another one, a collection of essays published by the World Future Society, in which I also have some contributions. As I suggested in the Bible study and the book of Revelation is constructed around the number 7. And as we try to get a handle on the world problematique. By world problematique, I'm taking that term from the Club of Rome study. We're talking about the whole confluence of problems that are endemic not only to our own society, but to the whole globe. And what we need to do is find a way of organizing our thinking about the problems. There's so many, they're so big. And I thought that perhaps it might be helpful to just use that number 7. Especially insofar as almost all of the futurists that I know of, when it comes to the factual data, are pessimists, that we might as well go ahead and call it an apocalypse, and that's what I have done here. I call it Peter's Apocalypse, and we're going to try and take the world situation and divide it into 7 categories. Note that's a bit arbitrary, but whenever you're trying to organize chaos, oops, Don Kirk said last night, chaos doesn't exist, only turbulence does. So when you're trying to organize turbulence, you need to do it in one way or the other, and I'm going to organize it in terms of 7 fears. That is to say, apprehensions about possible courses of events that will lead in one way or another, if not to radical change, but to the actual demise of civilization as we know it. There are very few futurists that I know of that believe that the civilization that you and I presently live in will continue beyond the year 2000 in its present form. what are the things that we're afraid of? And the first fear is what I call the fear of not having enough energy. As you know, our economy seems to be overly dependent upon petroleum, but that petroleum is beginning to run out. We began to realize this when the Arabs invoked their embargo in 1974 or so. It's interesting that just about 1972, 2 years prior to that, the Club of Rome published their study called The Limits to Growth. How many people have read that particular book? Anybody? It was a landmark book. And in this book, the Club of Rome computerized world trends. And what's important here is that they used the concept of the world now instead of the nation or the region. And they tried to catalog in their computer five major factors in world trends: industrial production, agricultural production, let's see, what were the other ones? Pollution production, population growth, and there was a fifth one in there. I can't remember what it was. At any rate, non-renewable natural resource production was one of their exploitation was one of their categories, and they said if present trends continue, by the year 2020, all of our petroleum resources will be gone. By the year 2019, all of our natural gas will be gone. Coal will last till 2120. Point: fossil fuels are limited. That book was published in 30 languages immediately, and although the information is not in, I suspect that the historians sometime later are going to look back and they're going to say that that book precipitated the Arab oil embargo of 73-74, because that book was read in the halls of state of every country around the world. And I can just imagine the Arabs saying, uh-oh, we got to get our cut now. Global 2000 report, which Charlie Mays and others here at Holden this summer have been trying to use as a basis for factual information, maintains that we will hit the peak of oil production by 1990. That is to say that consumption will be, or the demand will be, much greater than our ability to produce it. We may never run out of oil, because the price will simply go up and up and up, and people will stop buying it before the last drop is finally taken from the earth. Whether the price goes up or whether we use it all up, the point is the future of petroleum is not indefinite. It's going to come to a halt, and it's going to come to a halt in the medium range future. We're talking about the next half century or so. At present, our U.S. energy consumption is 46% oil, 28% coal, 18% natural gas. That's 92% of our energy resources come from fossil fuel. Only 8% come from hydroelectricity and nuclear power combined. The best projections are that in the year 2000, that'll go up to 17% for hydro and nuclear. We're really strapped, especially if energy consumption continues to grow at a worldwide rate of 5% per year. We're simply not going to meet all of the demand after the turn of the century. The watchword has been, then, in the late 1970s, let's find alternative sources for energy. But like all watchwords, you got to watch them, because they're usually hiding something. And what's hidden in that watchword, alternative sources of energy, is the assumption that our problem is a technical one, or a technological problem, for which there is a technological solution. In the Club of Rome study, they said this is the big mistake, because the problem that our civilization faces now is not a technological problem, it's a problem of values. It's a crisis in values. That the assumption of consumption, the assumption that we have to continue to consume voraciously, is the problem, that there is going to be a finite limit to the amount of energy that we can consume no matter what, unless we change our values and eventually reduce the demand. Find a way to live in which the assumption of consumption is abrogated. Okay, the first fear is then that we won't have enough energy, and the second fear is that we will. If civilization doesn't come to an end because we fail to have enough energy, it's going to come to an end because we do have it. Everything is interconnected, so says the Club of Rome and other such theorists, and you can't continue to burn energy without producing pollution. There's a finite limit to the amount of anti-pollution devices that you can put on. No matter how good your anti-pollution device, there's always a residue of pollution that is produced, and you're going to continue. That's the first half. The second half is that we will deplete the non-renewable natural resources. The two go together, that we're liable to leave future generations on this planet impoverished, not having access to the same source of extractive wealth that we have had access to. In America, we have, since the Carter administration, sought to find a substitute for petroleum through expanded use of coal. And the president of the National Coal Association, Carl Begge, says, we can produce all of the coal that your machines can burn up. There's a great drive to switch from Arab oil dependency to American coal. But the problem is that if we are successful at making such a conversion, that you have a tremendous ecological problem on the other end. You've got the whole problem of strip mining. 3 million acres of land has already been strip mined without being reclaimed. It's very expensive to reclaim that particular land. Even with anti-pollution devices in the coal burning process, still there is a sulfur dioxide and nitric oxide emission, which when it enters the upper atmosphere mixes with water and eventually comes back to Earth in the form of acid rains. And acid rains have a tendency to kill fish and other forms of wildlife. Norway and Sweden lose $50 million a year in their fish, they claim. I know that in the Adirondack Mountains in New York, they've had serious fish kill-offs from acid rains, and I also understand secondhand that northern Minnesota has experienced the same problem. Well, in the last 20 years, the quantity of sulfur dioxide in our atmosphere has increased 50%, and the quantity of nitric oxide 130%. Coal is the greatest producer of these acidic or toxic elements, and as we increase the burning of coal, we're going to increase the production of acid rain. So that on down the line, for almost all of the energy sources of which we're speaking, there's going to be a pollution fallout of one kind or another. Now, the third fear is the proliferation of nuclear fission processes. Nuclear fission looks like the answer because there's so many good features about nuclear fission power, because you can take a relatively small amount of material. If you take enriched uranium-235, an ounce of that can produce as much heat as 100 tons of coal. And so in a relatively small space, you can produce a tremendous amount of power. And there is, in terms of the immediate operation of a nuclear power plant, no toxic emissions that go into the atmosphere. You get a lot of power, and it's relatively clean power. When I go through the Oakland airport, there's a little stand there, and maybe you've seen these stands in your airports too, and there's a group of very nicely dressed young men and women, and they're holding up a sign that reads like this: turn on your lights, turn up your air conditioners, turn on to the future of unlimited power, go nuclear. Sometimes they have nasty little signs about Teddy Kennedy and Jane Fonda. Well, the problem is that we've discovered that maybe the Atoms for Peace policy begun by General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, the 1950s, may finally be just as deadly as atomic war itself. Today is Hiroshima Day, and we know about the potential for thermonuclear war. I'm not considering that here in my seven calamities as seven trends leading towards the future. I don't consider nuclear war a trend. If anything, that's the end of a trend, and belongs in a category in, unto itself. The continuation of nuclear fission power, however, is a trend, and it is ominous, and in particular, my area of concern has been over the problem of high-level nuclear waste, or nuclear waste in general. Nuclear waste is not something you can dispose of by throwing it away in a garbage can. There is no disposal, there is only the perpetual care for the waste products that come out of nuclear reactors. High-level nuclear waste may sit around and simply boil at 1400 degrees continually for a number of years. The stainless steel containers in which they were buried at the Hanford Reservation here in Washington only last for 30 years or so, yet that material remains toxic for 10,000, and if you have plutonium in there, for a quarter of a million years. And consequently, every 30 years, you have to dump it from one container into another for how long? You know, a generation? In addition to that, it has to be cooled. It has to be cooled by what? Running water? At the La Hague plant in France, they cool these tanks of nuclear waste with air conditioners. And they have the air conditioners running 24 hours a day in order to keep this waste cool. And one time, about 6 years ago, they had a power failure, and the air conditioners went off for 8 minutes, and suddenly everybody in the neighborhood realized what a thin thread of safety is supporting their way of life. Here in America, President Carter started making plans for a long-range, deep mine disposal program for high-level nuclear waste that was to begin in 1996. And in the meantime, we would have serious research into finding the most safe way possible to dispose of this material. As you know, when President Reagan came in, he cut all those programs, speeded up the program by 10 years, issued the contract for the first disposal to be done by a corporation that had nothing to do with the original research program. Concern, by the way, my overall theme is that we can almost be assured of bad management and mistakes in this whole program. I was called to be a consultant for research into the problem that the Navajo Indians had at Window Rock in New Mexico, the New Mexico-Arizona Reservation. In July of 1979, the United Nuclear Corporation dumped 94 million gallons of radioactive water into the Rio Puerco River. It was an accident. It was low-level radiation that came out of one of their holding ponds. The New Mexico equivalent for the Regulatory Commission, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I can't remember the New Mexico name, came out and immediately cited the corporation and demanded that they be closed down. Within 24 hours, the governor of the state of New Mexico gave the corporation a full pardon, and they never had to stop their operation. In the meantime, the radioactive water spread out in a moraine for some 30 miles through the Navajo Indian Reservation. The Lutheran Church sponsored a team of scientists and others to go down and study the matter to find out whether or not the Indians could continue to drink the water. The livestock had immediately wandered into the river and drank the radioactive water, and so there was a big problem there. It seems to me, after my trip down there and talking with other officials, all of the officials from both the state of New Mexico and Arizona say that all of the teeth of all of the nuclear power regulations that went into effect in the 1970s have all been removed. The staffs are underfunded. Neither the state of New Mexico or the state of Arizona even has a laboratory for testing radioactive materials to do their research. So how can they possibly enforce the federal laws in these matters. Even if the best of all policies are formulated, you've got the problem of execution. Off the coast of San Francisco, we have the Farallon Islands, where low-level nuclear waste was dumped in around 1960. And this nuclear waste was put in 55-gallon steel drums and then sealed up. And it was taken out there and simply dumped into the ocean. I interviewed one of the employees that was working on this project and asked him, how many barrels got dumped out there? Well, he thought for a minute, and he said, oh, probably 2,500 or 3,000. And I said that I understand that some of the barrels leaked. He said, no, they didn't leak. Well, I said, but, you know, there's a congressman in California that's been complaining that some of the barrels leaked out there and that it's caused some excessive radioactivity in the area of the Farallon Islands. He said, well, maybe what he's thinking of is that we shot them. And I said, what do you mean you shot them? Well, he says, when we dumped the barrels overboard, some of them wouldn't sink, so we took out our guns and we shot them full of holes until they went down. Well, it seems to me that one thing we can count on over the long haul with any kind of dangerous process is human error, and it will occur probably, most probably, in this industry as well. Economist Schumacher has a little quote or a little passage in one of his books that I quote in here that gives us something to think about. E.F. Schumacher writes, "No degree of prosperity could justify the accumulation of large amounts of highly toxic substances which nobody knows how to make safe and which remain an incalculable danger to the whole of creation for historical or even geological ages. The idea that civilization could sustain itself on the basis of such a transgression is an ethical, spiritual, and metaphysical monstrosity. It means conducting the economic affairs of man as if people really didn't matter at all." The fourth fear is the Gemini problem, the combination of population overgrowth and the production of food. The world population is growing at a rate of 1.8% per year. Right now, that means we will double the number of people in the world in 38 years. And as you're probably aware, the actual rate of growth in the poorer countries is much higher than it is in our own. In our own country, our population grows at the rate of 0.6% per year. In the poor nations, from 2.1 to 3.5% per year. From 1950 to 1975, Mexico doubled its population in only a quarter of a century. That's what's going to be happening. As this happens, though, the relative number of poor people over against rich people is going to change. Right now in the world, in the so-called developed countries, you have 1.1 billion people, and you have 2.9 billion people in the lesser developed countries. 28% of us, 72% of them, by the year 2000, will go up to 1.3 billion, but the poor people in the lesser developed countries will go up to 5 billion. The ratio will be 80% to 20%. Now, if you're thinking in terms of economic equity, economic justice or one kind or another, you're going to be sadly disappointed because that's not the way the world is going. There is one optimist amongst the futurists, that's Herman Kahn. He believes that the absolute wealth of everyone in the world is on the increase, so that poor people today will have a little bit more money in the year 2000 than they do now. Rich people will have proportionately more. So that if you can swallow the fact that there will be a small island of rich people amidst a great ocean of poverty, he says, then you can be pleased that we'll all be better off in the year 2000. On a relative scale, there's no question, however, that poverty is increasing. We've got a continued problem of energy loss or loss of resources for energy in the third world. Loss of timber, for example, because people do not have the money to pay for petroleum anymore, since the prices have gone up, there's an increased use of wood for fuel, and wood is being burned at the rate of half of the state of California every year. That amount of forest is simply permanently gone, or at least it's not being replanted, so that the amount of timber is going down. Housing. Because of population growth, the most conservative estimate for the population in the year 2000 is 5.9 billion. Most estimates hit somewhere around 6.2, 6.3 billion. There's going to be a housing shortage not only in this country but others. People in Java are now living in the mouths of relatively active volcanoes because they don't have other places to live. 200,000 people live on the sidewalks of Calcutta with no other place to live. Calcutta, by the way, may be the second largest city in the year 2000 with 20 million people. Mexico City will be the largest, most likely, with 31 million people. And if you've driven Mexico City, you know that the traffic is going to be awful. In terms of food production, the actual food production will probably increase between the now and the year 2000. The per capita food production will increase about 15%. Now that sounds like good news. The only problem is that the techniques that we're going to have to use to increase that food production are going to have short-term value and high expense and long-term disaster. Why? Because the available land that we can put under cultivation will increase by only 4%. Where will the increased food production come? It'll come from increased use of fertilizer and other technological methods for getting the existing cultivated land to produce more. The long-term effect may be soil exhaustion. So that even though we may do relatively well for 20 years, it may be a problem of depleting the ability of the earth to produce more food in the generation or two beyond that. In addition to that, the technology necessary to produce that food will become more expensive as we take nitrogen from petroleum and other kinds of sources, which means we've got a natural channel for keeping the food amongst the rich people and shuttling it away from the poor people. Which leads to our fifth fear, and that is nuclear blackmail. As nuclear fission processes proliferate around the world, both domestic as well as military, more and more people are going to have access to this high technology. And the fear is growing that terrorist groups, the mafia, or political organizations may seek through pilfering, espionage, or whatever other procedure to obtain nuclear power. The mafia or somebody like that could hold a city at bay with just a pound or two of plutonium if it's dropped in the Hetch Hetchy Dam. Just a pound of plutonium in the Hetch Hetchy, behind the Hetch Hetchy Dam above San Francisco could, unless people were warned, simply wipe out the city of San Francisco through poisoning. What might be worse, even an atomic bomb of one kind or another. So also an impoverished nation that has nuclear capability could, in time of crisis, threaten to explode the bomb, either surreptitiously by taking it in through smuggling or perhaps dropping it from the sky, drop that bomb on a wealthy nation. Say, either you give us X number of dollars or quantity of wealth, or we will detonate this bomb. We could threaten to retaliate by saying, well, you drop a bomb on us, we'll drop one on you. A country whose back is against the wall can say, well, we don't have anything else to lose. New form of international politics may finally make the emergence. 475 pounds of plutonium, by the way, are missing from American nuclear power inventories. The sixth fear, values turmoil. Even if we don't hit a major economic or military crisis within the next decade or two, even if those problems were settled, we've got another one that probably is far more closer to home and probably one that you and I experience on a day-to-day level that is very potent, and that's what I call values turmoil. Or pluralism. Pluralism means different value systems trying to live side by side and having social and cultural intercourse with one another. We're upset because of the very high divorce rate. 1.2 million divorces in this country every year. 1 million divorces in Norway and Sweden every year. Time magazine ran an article a couple of years ago about having sexual intercourse outside of marriage and described how 7 out of 10 unmarried teenage women in this survey were having sexual relations outside of marriage, and how socially approvable this was. And there's a little line. It used to be called living in sin, but today it's a change in lifestyle. One poor fellow who wasn't convinced by that wrote a letter to the editor, which appeared a couple issues later. You say it used to be called living in sin. I still call it that. There's a conflict afoot between changing values. And I believe that we Americans have a very high tolerance for change. I think we can tolerate a great deal of change. This is an ordinary change. This is a challenge to our values. Our values are those things that provide the very foundation for our world of meaning, those things that have intrinsic worth. And upon the intrinsic worth of these values, do we make our decisions and do we find life meaningful? And our world of meaning is constructed around these values. What's happening now is that these values are being challenged. The foundation is being eroded. And the world of meaning is thrown up for grabs. That's the problem that I think we're having. I mean, 20 years ago, you could talk about motherhood, and everyone would nod their heads and believe in the fine virtues associated with motherhood. And for you to invest 40 years of your life in being a mother, you knew that the anchor was solid, the foundation was there, and this was a meaningful life. Not so in the 1970s. Now in the 1970s, it's possible to criticize motherhood, to describe it as a naive form of self-imposed depression from which one can be liberated by choosing another form of life. And so a woman who may have given 40 years of her life is now saying, gee, did I do the right thing? Was I really a sap? Was I really a sucker? And so the very foundations of meaning are being loosened. And the sexual revolution is one symptom of this. The church is not helped. The church is part of the problem. And at least in the past, if things there was a variety of different views in society, you could always go to the church and expect the church to say the same thing. Not so anymore. If a young lady out of wedlock finds herself pregnant and she's wondering what she can do, she can go to the pastor down the street, and this pastor will tell her that she has a right to find a life that is self-fulfilling, that she ought not to ruin her opportunities for career and education, and that she ought to go and obtain an abortion. She may go across the street and visit another church, maybe across town, visit a church of the same denomination, talk to that pastor. That pastor will say, on the basis of the Ten Commandments, nasty things about adultery, nasty things about murder, and say that she has every responsibility to bring that child to term and to raise that child to adulthood as a loving mother should. Where does one turn? We can assume, and I think that you and I have both met pastors of both stripes, of equal integrity, of equal concern, and here on an extremely important life and death issue, they can't even agree as to what it is that's right and wrong. And so, values turmoil is something that I think creates a tremendous amount of anxiety. The place where most of it seems to be focused, to my observation, is in the life of the family. Next week, I'm going to give one talk on the future of the family. And even though I cannot solve any of these problems, at least I'll try to help make them more clear, if that helps at all. One thing I have to say, though, by way of comment over the values turmoil, especially when it comes in terms of the generational conflict, that even though our pastors may not know the difference between right and wrong, or at least disagree, that's a better way to put it, as to what's right and what's wrong, There is one constant that I've observed in my ministry and that I think that we can still be concerned with, and that's the kind of love that is described by Jesus in his parable of the lost son. In particular, I can think of a couple family situations in my parish in New Orleans. One where the young man in college went off to live in the mountains with a Hindu guru, gave up his Christianity to become a Hindu mystic, and wouldn't get a job. In the other case, it was the girl in her early 20s was living with a man out of wedlock, became pregnant, etc., and again had left the church. In both cases, the parents, totally upset by the road that the paths that their children had taken, never flagged in their love for their kids, and they always kept that door open. And at least in the case of the young lady, she married the fellow and eventually joined the church, and there was a family reunion despite the earlier alienation. As far as I know, the other parents are still like the prodigal's father, waiting in the window for their son to come home. That constant parental love, I think, is something that is an absolute. I don't think we have to give that up, even though we may sometimes disagree with one another as to just how that love ought to be executed. The last of the seven fears is the scientific advance in the field of chemistry and biology. We have experienced a number of crises since the 1950s. DDT, which Charlie Mays mentioned the other night, seems to be almost ubiquitous in the food chain now. We've had the thalidomide generation. We've had our bout with polyvinyl chloride and its cancerous effects. We've got Navajo Indians dying by the hundreds, if not thousands, after having worked in the uranium mines without protection. We've got the threat of fluorocarbons depleting our ozone layer. At least that's been postulated as a possibility. The biological scientists are looking forward to what's going on in the laboratory as perhaps a revolution in our way of life that may be even bigger than that of the Industrial Revolution. That is to say, changes will come out of the laboratory of such high cultural impact that we're going to have to change our way of thinking about many different things. The planning of the sex of our children is not going to be too far off into the future. And although that sounds really great when you're thinking maybe about yourself or some immediate relatives, but if you consider it sociologically, we could get ourselves in a heck of a mess. Right now, there's a delicate mechanism in which a few more boys are born than girls, but nature kills off the boys faster than girls, so that at marrying age, they're about the right number, and then as they grow older, of course, we have more women than we do men. But if we plan offspring, suppose over one decade, everybody wants girls, and we have too few boys, then Congress will pass a law that no more girls going to have boys. By the time it takes effect, we'll have too many boys and not enough girls. The pendulum will keep swinging. How are we ever going to get it back in balance again? Frozen organ banks for medical purposes are not that far away. Mind-modifying drugs, and when I say this, I don't mean cocaine or marijuana. I'm talking about drugs for the specific purpose of increasing human intelligence, so that maybe you'll have short-term drugs that you would take to increase your thinking power, or perhaps long-term, that maybe through genetic manipulation and the use of drugs, you could actually produce children who would be more intelligent than their mothers and fathers. And if we produced a whole generation of people like that, I think inevitably there would be a conflict between that generation and their stupid parents, relatively stupid parents. Maybe they're stupid for more than one reason. Chemical abortifacients are just around the corner, where you can have an abortion by taking a pill that would make it as easy as taking an aspirin. The idea of cloning of frogs, has already been done, but the idea of cloning larger animals, that is to say, producing exact duplicates from a non-procreative cell of a human being, is a possibility that we could produce a large numbers of people with exactly the same genetic formula. disembodied human brains, cyborgs, to keep a brain alive without a body is something sought for by some scientists somewhere around the turn of the century. Then combining human beings with other beings, humans with animals, creating humanoids, and humans with plants, humanids. The most fearsome of the experiments in biology, though, as I understand it, are experiments with recombinant DNA. With recombinant DNA, it is possible, perhaps, to create a life form that hitherto has never existed. The fear among some scientists is that if one were to create a cancerous life form of one kind or another, and should it escape the laboratory, perhaps by accidentally being poured down the drain or through some other method, it may go through the sewer system, eventually dumped into the ocean, get into a bed of shellfish, and spread eventually throughout the world, eliminating the human race as we know it. And consequently, there is at least one group of scientists pressing for the kind of safeguards and laboratory operation to try and prevent this from happening. People who are pessimistic and think that if an accident can happen, it will, Murphy's Law, are very frightened by that. George Wald, Nobel laureate in physiology and medicine for 1967, says that human life is now threatened as never before, not by one, but by many perils, each in itself capable of destroying us, but all interrelated and all coming upon us together. This kind of apocalyptic thinking, which does not belong to the religion, the household of religion, has at least been pervading the literature and the conversations amongst futurists now for 12 years.
Chuck? I think the fifth thing is thermal pollution.
Oh, I think there was pollution with some subcategories. See, I might have them written down here. Yeah, I know what you're thinking about. Let's see. All right, I got it. Industrial growth, agricultural growth, population growth, which includes hunger and malnutrition, depletion of non-renewable natural resources, and pollution. Is that five?
Yeah,
I think that's the five. Yeah, agricultural growth also increases pollution when you have to use nitrogen and other kinds of chemicals to make the crops grow. Then those chemicals leach through the soil and into the water supply, so that both industrial and agricultural growth inevitably produce pollution in their mind. Well, I have 5 minutes to five. The next, what I was going to do now is to suggest ways in which religious people have responded. And the fourth of those ways is what I call proleptic eschatology, which is my topic for tomorrow. The board spelled it wrong. He ended up with prophetic. It's really proleptic, and I'll define that tomorrow. But in the meantime, perhaps I should just see if there's any response here before we break on the question of the apocalypse.
The sources, you talked about nuclear fission.
Yes.
I guess the potential for that could be long range, except the pollutant after that poison. In the earlier forms of nuclear energy, the stuff from which nuclear energy was made didn't have a very long potential either. It was soon run out of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, some of the materials are more toxic and more long-lasting than others. Plutonium, for example, is one of the worst. But even the milder stuff that you must use, the fuel rods, for example, presently are considered waste. And they're toxic, depending on the material in them, for 10,000 years. I mean, seriously toxic. And the more we use them, I think the greater the opportunity for an accident to occur. We already have accidents in the hundreds every year. But any good industry is going to prepare for accidents and protect us from them. But as you increase the number of plants and the number of years and the number of processes, it seems to me that sooner or later, a major disaster is important.
I was talking to Werner, asking him if he talked to Leo Bustad on this subject recently, nuclear radiation biologist who listed the village, and because I know he in the past had felt very strongly that nuclear energy was the short-term way we had to go. And I was asking him what his current thinking was, since you get such diverse views on the subject.
Yes.
And he said it was still exactly as it was a few years ago, and that he still feels that it
is the best,
is controllable and safer than the other methods we have. And, and of course I was commenting on something that, you know, you talk about these items being toxic for 10,000 years, but everything is relative, and I'm not sure of the levels you're speaking of, but it's like the granite rocks are very toxic too, and they have demonstrable levels of radiation in them. And some of the studies that point out the extreme lengths of time these are, quote, toxic, they are down at the level of our present rocks. And
so we
have to be a little tempered in our definition.
Yeah, the statistics I was giving you were those levels of toxicity which are dangerous. In fact, plutonium is toxic for 500,000 years. The 250,000 year figure is given as that point at which it returns to, or that point at which it ceases to be dangerous. So the only, you're right, the only important statistics are the statistics having to do with human danger. But that's what they are. The Department of Energy thumbnail picture of how long we need to care for a deep mine nuclear waste disposal is 1,000 years. So that thinking that after 1,000 years or so, knowing the material still may be dangerous for 10,000, at least it's still the case that the worst danger is in the immediate 30 years, and then after that it's continually decreasing. So they're talking about if they could establish a system of monitoring for 1,000 years, they feel that they'd be okay. Still, 1,000 years is quite a while.
Each and every one does have a half-life, though.
Yeah,
it is a continuing, reducing thing. It isn't like that 10,000 years is what it was the day you put it.
That's correct.
Any matter of fact.
That's correct.
Some people exaggerate that. What did
you
say?
You keep adding fresh waste.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one of the things I do discuss in my book, and it came up in an earlier forum this week, is nuclear fusion, you know, and you don't want to spread around unnecessary optimism, but I'd be very optimistic about that, should it come in. But even at your most optimistic estimates, you're talking about the mid-1990s, if everything goes well. Nuclear fusion, it would be a nuclear process. It takes nuclear fission to get it going, but just a little bit. And after that, nuclear fusion produces almost, or relatively, a pollution-free source of power. And you could run it virtually on seawater, and you can have a reasonably clean source of energy in large quantity. There are those kinds of hopeful signs. There are critics of nuclear fusion too, but that's why I specified nuclear fission. I wouldn't want people to get so panicky about no nukes of any kind and then, you know, prevent what may become a really really beneficial form of nuclear power.
But that's sort of what's happening, isn't it? With all the regulations, it's practically impossible to open any
The regulation is economic, which is the basis for our system. The reason we've shut down two power plants in this part of the country is because they can't pay for themselves. When I hear people say regulation, I think regulation as far as the NRC is concerned is laughable when they talk about cutting the time in half. You look at Three Mile Island, and the core did melt down, they're saying now. And then you say regulation for safety. My God, where do you live? What we're looking at in the Northwest here is simply economics. That's why they've been shut down. They're building those stupid things and we don't need them. And they can't pay for themselves. So let's not blame regulation. Let's look at the economic system.
I've got 5 o'clock. Do you?
Yeah, a couple minutes too.
A couple minutes too. All right, good.
In listening to the 7 apocalyptic statements, it sounds like there's no hope. And it seems like Holden is moved into one of the reactions of that and trying to be self-sufficient and isolated.
There are different ways of thinking about the future, and one of the ways that I've assumed here is to think globally, to assume the interconnectedness of the whole globe. And that's the way most futurists think. If you're going to make that a moral issue or a theological issue, then escapism, if that means that you would try to find shelter for a small group of people, you know, and let the rest of the world kind of go its own way, then that would be a different set of moral principles. And some people have chosen that route. I'm going to assume that that's not the route that I'm going to advocate. Where Holden would fit in that is that, yeah, Holden is an isolated community, but it also seems to me that Holden has a very active philosophy of somehow or other making a contribution to the global network. And to me, that's very, very much alive here. Then I think you could distinguish between retreat and involvement. I would picture Holden as a retreat place. I mean, everyone needs to retreat. If you fire a gun, you got to load it up, you know. And maybe Holden is a place where you load it up. I think if Holden were to become a place where people would live indefinitely, so as to avoid the turmoil the rest of the world is experiencing, then you might call it escapist. But at least the Holden mission, as I see it presently conceived, probably would not fit that.
It couldn't survive very long as an escape place. It's got all these tendrils that it needs sticking out there to supply it with food and everything else. Mm-hmm. It's foolish to think about this place of survival.
Maybe what Holden's after is a lower level of consumption, but self-sufficiency, that's not what it's after. Yeah, one of the ways I think we would like to protect ourselves, if possible, is to isolate ourselves and become self-sufficient.
We could eat tailings to get less alive.
Mary
Schramm said to serve them on the buffet.
Mm-hmm.